Episode 123 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before we get started today, I want to thank our sponsors, CME Group and Trading Technologies. Today I spoke to a man who grew up watching the markets thanks to his grandpa. He began his career as a stockbroker, but wanted to get away from sales and get into trading. He designed an algo and an online brokerage firm that got him promoted into product management, and since then he's designed option spread trading matching engines, worked on electronic options market making desks, built options products at various exchanges, was a COO at Equitech, and is now the co-founder of 233 Tactical Trading. His name is Jonathan Schlossberg. Today, Jonathan and I had a great discussion about the hedge fund industry. We talked about the technology problems that they are currently facing, and he explains the intersection of technology and human experience to help solve some of those problems. We talked about the flaws of some of the metrics that measure hedge fund performance, and I asked Jonathan if he thinks there's a cultural shift happening in hedge funds and if it needs to be revamped. He also talked about the most important aspects of his trading. Now, I have interviewed a lot of smart people on this show, but Jonathan ranks at the top of the list. He has worked in many facets of the industry and understands markets as well as anyone. Not to mention, he's a really good guy. I know you will learn a lot from Jonathan's show today. Thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Great to speak with you today. Now, when we started discussions for this show, we came up with some really great topics about what's happening in the hedge fund industry, so I'm very excited to dig into those topics today with you. But before we do that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How'd you get your start in the industry? And take us through your journey a bit to becoming the co-founder of 233 Tactical Trading.
You know, I guess if I go all the way back, my interest in the industry predated any exposure to working in it. As a kid, I was very interested in the market. My grandfather was involved in the market. I just started chasing it. And I thought I was going to be planning retirement accounts for a group of investors that I had pulled into a brokerage. And I originally started off as a stockbroker. To be honest with you, I found that to be decidedly disenchanting. I thought I was going to be planning for retirements. And as it turned out, it was more tantamount to used car sales. You know, I at the time worked for a while, got my licensing, and then decided I wanted to get away from sales and get into trading. So that, you know, this is back in circa 2000. I went to Daytech, which is an online brokerage, and originally I was just working kind of on the help desk in the trading area, but eventually I moved into the trade room, which is where, you know, it was an online broker, so they didn't have proprietary trading, but you didn't have the same fat finger checks that were in place today at these retail brokerage houses, and there were a lot of errors that would happen, and the way they would handle the errors is they'd drop it into an error account, and you would trade out of it. So that was my first foray into trading. It's also how I got my, it was the first chance I had to be involved with product management and algo design. So after working there for a little bit, I had realized that I had sort of systematized my approach to managing these positions, mostly because I didn't trust my emotions during the day. So I would make all my decisions at night. And then the next day, I would just follow by rote mechanism what I had decided the day before. In essence, I was running an algorithm. I didn't realize it at the time. I was sort of naive about what I was doing. I just had a system. It seemed like a logical way to address the criteria by which I was judged. And I eventually put together a plan to automate the whole thing. I went to my boss And he proceeded to say, yes, we ended up getting rid of that department. We automated the whole process. And I realized I almost lost my job, but instead I became a product manager. So that was really how I got into trading specifically and how I got into algo development. For a number of reasons, I started looking to leave Datech. You know, this is just prior to them selling to Ameritrade. That writing was on the wall, and I didn't want to be part of a merger. I ended up leaving and going to the International Security Exchange. And I got away from trading a little bit, but I got into more in-depth algo development. I built the matching engines for the ISE spread book, which, you know, nowadays is probably 50% of the volume on ISE, which recently got purchased. It's also kind of changed, I think, the landscape of the market in general. Right after ISE came out with their spread book and started getting large chunks of volume, the other exchanges really built up that same functionality. And today, I think we see a lot more spread trading as a result of that. In any case, I worked at ISE for a while. I think I really honed my skills in as it relates to designing technological solutions for trading and doing it with a rigor that you have in an exchange. So I worked there for a while. I got approached by Bank of America in about 2005. They were launching a hybrid marketplace, and this was a paradigm shift where they're moving away from the traditional floor. What I ended up doing was running the upstairs desk for the specialist unit of Bank of America with a C. So this is after Fleet and Bank of America merged. Bank picked up the New York Stock Exchange specialist unit, which represented about 20% of the volume that traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And again, circa 2005, so the New York was probably about 70% or so of the market share prior to hybrid in their names, and we saw that drop to about 25%. I think I got that job because I came out of options, and options had just gone through a similar paradigm shift on SIBO. So came in, we built out a market-making operation where we traded maybe 25 million shares a day upstairs in listed equities in New York in about 500 different names. And we also built out a risk desk. So the specialists, they were overcapitalized because of rules in New York Stock Exchange. But they had about $4 billion of cash. And we were trading that without any sort of risk hedging when I first got there. So we also rolled out a desk. So that was really an advancement in my participation in fully automated algorithmic trading. I ran that for a few years. Eventually, I got promoted to run electronic options product for GCIB, Global Corporate Investment Bank for Bank of America. Did that for a few years. We ended up with a Merrill merger. Left there, started an option product at Lime Brokerage, which was a brokerage really focused on high frequency, high performance execution. Worked there for a little bit. Went to F10 NASDAQ to roll out their product. They had a number of clients that they had stood up on an equity platform, but part of the initial engagements with them required an options platform, so I built that out for them. And then I realized I didn't want to do product development anymore. Honestly, at the end of the day, I think I'm a trader. I think I look at everything through the rose-colored glasses of trading. My children will refer to things in trading vernacular. If they don't like something, they're huge sellers. So I see probabilities. I see exchanges. I think we all have time as a commodity, and we exchange it for product services and experience. You know, I also realize that management is not what I want to do. So I ran into an old colleague. He was also in a similar state of mind, and we decided to go get back to what we used to do. And this is about 2010. I called two people. I called Blair Hull and I called Steve Tooman. And Steve Tooman said, meet me tomorrow. And Blair said, meet me in 6 weeks. So we hopped on a plane from New York. We flew out to Chicago. And at the end of that meeting, Steve funded us. So I never had my meeting with Blair Hull at the time. I started an equity desk. It was called Monk Castle. And we traded, you know, a couple million shares a day of equities. And, you know, on a busy day, we might trade 20,000 contracts of listed options. on a slow day, we might only trade a couple hundred. And we ran that for a while. I became chief operating officer of Equitech, which is a prop shop. It's owned by what I like to call a triumvirate. Dan Asher, John LaRocque, and Steve Tooman, they're the main partners. Phenomenal human beings. That was actually why I moved to Chicago. You know, I had done business with Steve for years before I worked for him. And every conversation started off about my daughter. So, moving out here, which to me was a big commitment to the, with my family. It was very easy when I was joining a group that put family first. So I came out here, worked for them. They started my desk. I have a penchant for technology, though I would not qualify myself traditionally as a technologist, more of a trader or a quant, if anything. But, they had a number of needs. They came from a very traditional market making background, and I had the capacity to advance their business and compress their expenses on the technology front. So they first made me their chief information officer, eventually their chief operating officer. And for the last 5 years prior to this last year, 6 years, I should say, I continued to run that equity option desk with a partner, and I was the COO of Equitech, which brings me to about this time last year. The firm I was with, I wanted to kind of grow and add some new businesses, and they've been very successful, and they really weren't looking to change anything. And I decided to go out on my own, which they were very supportive of. And honestly, I tried to support them on the way out. Obviously, a COO is a central role, so it was a three-month period trying to get out of there. But I started up two companies. One was just a technology company to support building stuff out, and the other was 233 Tactical Trading. And 233 was built on a lot of lessons learned. It's in a lot of ways, it is the aggregate of the experience I've accumulated over the last about 18 years in the marketplace. Actually, even the name 233. 233 is an ode to a guy that helped bring me into the industry. That was his clearing ID. He still actually does an execution business in equity options. His name is Pat Carroll. He runs Compass Execution, or he's running the business development for Compass Execution right now. But 233 was his clearing ID. He gave me a shot in the industry. Tactical is actually the idea that we built out that actually took advantage of what my experience was based on a question that Blair Hull posed. There's this whole concept of efficient market theory, and the academics would say you can't time the market. Empirical data and my track record would suggest that efficient market theory is clearly not encompassing 100% of the market behavior. That said, though, it's programmed into academia right now that you can't time the market. And to a certain extent, I kind of agree in principle, but there are inefficiencies in the market. And technology, computing power is advanced. Mathematically, we've come up with far more sophisticated mathematical applications to quantify behavior. And Blair, not long ago, said, I question the thesis. And he did a little article that we read, my partner and I. It precipitated a little investigation, and we came up with a trade based on his principle. So 233 Tactical Trading is really an ode to the past, and it reflects where we're going in the future. So that's kind of how I got here. We started up an SPX futures trade. We got seed funding from, a name in the industry. And now we're really taking that. I had some involvement with another hedge fund named Flammarion, and they're out of New York. They run a treasury futures trade. And now we're kind of pushing those two trades. We have a couple new trades that we're going to be rolling out as well. We have a currency trade we're rolling out. But all of this is starting to coalesce into a single holding corporation of sorts, mostly in the futures space right now. But, certainly we're looking all over the place.
Wow, love that backstory. That was awesome. And what I really took from your backstory was the fact that you were always using cutting-edge technology in the industry. I love that. And it seemed like you were always ahead of the curve in your decision-making as to what was going to be happening next in the industry. That was really cool. Now, today we're going to talk about the hedge fund industry, which right now seems to be having a few battles on their hands. And one is a technological battle, And some would even say it's an upheaval happening right now in technology and happening in the hedge fund space. So you had some strong thoughts on this. Can you share that with our audience?
So it's a pretty interesting space. I mean, and I don't know if there's a single theme here. There's a number of different trends that are all happening. And I hate to overuse the word coalesce, but I think that was like 30 seconds ago I used it. But they are also coalesced into an outcome, right? So, you know, I think everybody kind of looks at things from their own little bias, right? If you talk about what the future means, well, if you ask a doctor, he's going to tell you about the impact of medicine and how it's going to change life. You ask a computer engineer, software engineer, he's going to tell you how technology is going to change life. The reality is both of these trends are real, and it's the intersection of the two that's going to dictate the outcome. So let me just wrap that back into technology and hedge funds. You know, we went through a period that you have participants that are on different sides of dealing with technology. Some of them had very antiquated models, did not update their technology, and now they feel like they're playing catch up. There's another group of people that threw incredible amounts of money into technology. And at the time, there was enough market to justify the expenditure. But now they've built a trading paradigm that requires technology to be successful. And they find with compressing margins and smaller opportunity, they are looking to cut their technology. And they're trying to figure out how to get off of the crush that they've created to compete. So, you know, I think right now, the pure technology arb is gone. I think the key in technology now is coming up with innovative technologies that minimize your footprint, that continue to give you the benefits of compressed expenses, but still keep you competitive in the marketplace. And I do think that the hedge fund space is reeling with the reality that you used to be able to get a tech arb. And by that, I mean you were able to spend enough money on technology that you would have enough of an advantage over your competitor that would give you less adverse selection and the ability to perform. That market's saturated now. And the people who are competing in the tech arb have far larger budgets than most. And you really don't want to, you know, I'm not looking to get into a wallet fight with Goldman Sachs, for example. And Goldman is by no means a problem in this space. And just from a scale perspective, 233 Tactical Trading doesn't have the capital to compete with Goldman Sachs. So I don't want to get into a strategy where I have to maintain a commensurate environment to compete. And I think that, you know, for a long time, people relied on technology. And I don't think nowadays with the participants involved, you're able to differentiate yourself that way. And that's part of what the shakeout is. I mean, there's a big shakeout, I think, that's going to happen in hedge funds. And it is the product of a number of things. Some of it has to do with the hedge funds themselves. Some of it has to do with the way the industry is set up. And some of it is just simple human psychology and the way people work around a reward basis. In any case, you know, as it relates to technology, I think you're going to have two types of issues that these hedge funds are dealing with. One, you have people who've just built up far too large of a footprint and overhead, or whether they make money or not, it costs too much to run, and these guys are going to be compressing. On the other side of the spectrum, you have people who have just waited this long to even get involved in technology. They're playing catch-up, and they're desperately trying to sift through the myriad of third-party vendor solutions, which is a non-trivial exercise, by the way. Marketing obfuscates what real function is. And, you know, if you haven't been current and you haven't been keeping up with the trend, then it's a daunting task. So those are the two technology things I think we're seeing. I know there's a lot of new technologies coming out, a lot of question about genetic algorithms, automated intelligence, and we can talk about that more.
Yeah, we can go all day talking about the different types of technology out there being used right now, but I want to comment on something that you mentioned, and I thought it was really good. It was when you said, you know, hedge funds were spending money on tech arb, you know, trying to outspend their competitors, and that would give them an advantage. And you believe that that has kind of now run its course. And I completely agree with that. And not from understanding it the same place that you did, just from my perspective of a trader, I always said to myself, I said, you know what, there's going to be a race for speed. You're going to get to a point where speed is going to wear itself out, and you're going to have a handful of people that are the fastest, and they're going to win that battle. And then, you know, other traders that are spending money that cannot compete with them are not going to have to find different ways. And I think we are already seeing that. I mean, I talk to a lot of people in the industry. I spend a lot of time at events, and although speed is constantly being talked about, it's not being talked about as much. It's now more about what are we going to do now that we have good enough speed? How can we get smarter? How can we get better? And I think that from an individual trader, as I've been my whole career, I understand that, you know, this moment, it happens to everybody, no matter who you are. At some point, you know, somebody better than you figures out a way and spends enough money, and then you can't compete with them anymore on that same game. And then the game changes for you. As an individual trader, as a scalper my whole career, I've had to learn to slow it down now, trade less, trade smarter, have a stronger hand in the market. So I can completely relate to that, and, you know, just obviously on a much smaller scale. So I really love that. And I think that all traders listening to this have to take note. It's like, look at even the hedge funds, even the top people in the industry have to adapt and change to what's happening. So yeah, that was just a great point.
There's a difference between a brute force solution and an elegant solution. Right. And what does that mean? Well, I can throw horizontal scaling and servers at a computational problem. Right? Maybe I'm talking about some solution where I have to iterate through to come up with, you know, a Monte Carlo simulation or anything that's just a lot of processing. You could also come up with a closed form solution, which is deterministic in calculation and a lot less intensive. Now, it's far harder to come up with that elegant mathematical solution. But when you do, that to me is how people are going to differentiate themselves going forward as it relates to technology. It's going to be using all the benefits and all the advancements that has come from technology in terms of speed, throughput, et cetera. But it's not going to be who has the most guns. It's going to be who has a sniper rifle and knows how to use it most accurately. Slightly different way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love the analogy about the sniper rifle. Now, I want to talk about 2016 in hedge funds. It was a bad year for them. We had record outflows and pretty much poor performance across the board. My question to you is, why do you think that was? And do you think that 2017 will be a better year for hedge funds?
So the question hints at the answer. You said across the board. Let's just examine that for a second. So pretty much all hedge funds sort of suck. Why? Maybe it's because they all kind of look alike. You know, I think we have a problem in the industry. I think that, you know, and I think this is worthy of a lot more conversation than just what I'm about to say, but you don't have alignment between the risk reward of trading and the risk reward of the investment manager who's sitting behind or sitting in between the investor and the trader. You know, I think there's a lot of incentive to fit into a mold right now in the hedge fund industry. Why? Well, you know, hedge funds, now pretend you're an investor that has a lot of cash. So you go find a money manager and he goes out and he finds a number of different hedge funds to diversify your portfolio. Now, you have a couple of different money managers because you're a wealthy investor and you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket. That's rational. Well, you're actually your own problem right now because human nature is going to compare like things and you're going to start comparing your money managers. Now, if one money manager performs and the other ones don't, you're going to give them a pat on the back. Hey, great job. And you're going to say, you're going to keep your allocation. You're doing great for me. You're actually helping me out. The rest of the portfolio has come in a bit and you compensated. You dampened my volatility. But you're not going to give them a bigger allocation because you're diversifying your assets, right? I mean, maybe you throw a little bit extra at them, but not disproportionately. Right, so the return for performance is there, but not hugely so, because other economic considerations preclude the ability to give you more money. Now let's look at the opposite situation. Let's say that he underperforms. Well, you're going to look at the rest of your money managers, and in relative measure, he's not performed. And this is where the problem begins. Because the investor will pull the money from that money manager. And the rationale he'll give is, everybody else did well and you didn't. Well, if you continue to apply that methodology to finding money managers, eventually everyone will start to look alike, because that will guarantee that they don't get kicked out. And you'll feel better when you lose money, because everybody lost money. Oh, no, it wasn't that bad, money manager. I lost money everywhere. Or you have exposure to highly correlated returns. And, you know, one of the problems that we have is, in 2016, some hedge funds made money and some didn't. However, if you look at what the investment community is in, they've generally pushed themselves into the same types of strategies. So they all have similar types of returns. And when the very popular strategy has a shitty year, it happens holistically. So that's one reason why I think you're seeing this. I think if you had a diversified set of hedge fund exposures out there in the marketplace, the same hedge funds that we're looking at right now, you know, traditional long, short hedge funds or whatever you're looking at, they would have had similar performance that we saw in 2016. But if you had a more diversified set of hedge fund exposures, you wouldn't be making a statement that said the whole hedge fund community, almost everybody. That makes no sense. You have people who should have long and short exposures that should have things that have positive and negative correlations to S&P. If S&P goes up, some people should be in other products that go down. People should have long and short exposures. These things shouldn't be a situation where the entire community doesn't know how to trade anymore. So I think what that's really telling you is the community looks the same. I'm not sure there's a lot of options and variety inside that space. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, I think that we're going through a transition. You know, there was a time where trading used to be a very heuristic approach. You had floor traders. You had guys that had feelings. Now, I'm a quant, but I am probably more of a proponent of heuristics than most, because I think there's a value there. I have trouble quantifying it, so I won't trade it. But, you know, there is a value certainly to, you know, what a human being is able to process in their head. You know, and the future, in my opinion, of technology is really that intersection. We've weeded out a lot of the dead weight in trading, manual trading. The guys that are still here, they have a value, they have a knowledge. And compared to most of the community that's very young and hasn't seen interest rates and hasn't seen volatility, I think these guys are going to become all the more important going forward.
I want to talk about something else. When we talk about hedge funds and we talk about, you know, as I said, the performance really wasn't good across the board. Let's talk about the metrics in which that's measured. I mean, let's face it, investors are so much more sophisticated than they've ever been before. And I'm wondering if you think the reliance on metrics plays into what you just actually just spoke about.
Metrics is the tool that allows that normalization problem that I'm talking about. I'm going to pick a metric here just because it's very popular. So Sharpe ratio.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful thing. So to tell you the truth, there is some relevance with Sharpe. I mean, it's a metric to look at. It should be processed alongside of a lot of other metrics, but there's a few metrics that people seem to put a lot of credence in, and I don't know if that truly gives them the result they're looking for. So Sharpe ratio is basically return over variance, right? So it kind of gives you a risk-adjusted view of the marketplace, but it's a non-directional risk-adjusted view, right? If you make $1,000 every day consecutively for a whole year, that looks the same from a risk perspective as though you made $1,000, lost $1,000, made $1,000, lost $1,000. In one case, you made $252,000 in 250 days of trading. In the other case, you made exactly zero, right? But they have the same risk. And the investment community has been taught that they have to look at Sharpe ratio, right? So one, I don't think they understand the nature of a non-directional view of volatility, right? I mean, to make money, if you make money, you have volatility. So part of your goal includes volatility. If you judge me on how much I don't have volatility, you might be looking for somebody that doesn't make you a lot of money. I don't lose you a lot of money, but I'm not making you money, and you're investing in me to make money. But it's worse than just that. It's not just misunderstanding what the metric is. It's how you can produce better metrics that are actually worse for the investor. And let me explain that, if you don't mind. Imagine that I trade for a year, and every day I do a single trade. And some of those trades work out, and some of those don't. And when they work out, maybe they make, you know, 1 to 2%, and when they lose money, they lose 0 to 1%. So it's a profitable trading strategy, right? Assuming they happen in equal frequencies. So now I look at my Sharpe ratio, and let's just say I have a Sharpe ratio of 1.2. Right now, I can tell you that if you don't have a 2 Sharpe ratio, most investors, at least investors that can give you between $1 million and $5 million for an account, they're looking for a 2 Sharpe. Ask them why, they probably don't know, but they know that that's what they need. So now here's the interesting thing. If you looked at all of my trading days, some of those days would be up and some would be down. If I were to just cut profits every time I made, say, 5% in a day, I would cut some of my upsides, because maybe on some of those days I made 10%, but every time I made 5%, I took the money off the table. I would cut upside volatility. Now, I'm not going to implement in this hypothetical any downside protection. So I'm not cutting symmetrically any losses. So if we look at the two situations, in case one, I did all these trades and I made you some money. In case two, I did all these trades, but on only winning days that were big, I turned off trading early. So I'm actually going to make you a little less money, right? Because I have all the same losing days. I have all the same winning days, but the winning days aren't for as much. No, but here's the interesting thing. I just made you less money, but I cut volatility. I might show you a 2 Sharpe ratio, but let's examine that closely. I didn't cut any downside losses. That means I can give you a better Sharpe ratio by giving you all of the same losing days and just cutting some of the upside days. Now, let's pretend you're an investor and there's two groups coming to you. One doesn't cut upside. The other does. You're going to invest in the worst trade, because the worst trade is going to show you a higher Sharpe ratio. And because you have artificially depended on the metric that you neither understand, and you, on top of not understanding it, you put more credence in it than I think the inventor, Sharpe himself, would even say you should, you make an investment decision on potentially a very large amount of money. Well, that's really problematic. Because you're creating a situation where even the trader who tries to come up with a better trade that maybe doesn't fit into your metrics profile the right way, he's going to fail. He's not going to get funded, and he's going to go end up working for somebody else because he can't stand on his own 2 feet. The guy who says, I'm going to go with the flow. I'm going to cut the upside. I'm going to give them the Sharpe they want. He's going to get the seed. So, you know, this has been going on for a while now, and I think that, you know, 2016 is a combination of everybody looks the same, which means when that type of a strategy gets hurt, everybody gets hurt. And we've kind of created a world where being a good trader and doing what's best for the trade and the investor actually doesn't make you successful. You know, I think the intersection of those two things is really problematic. Metrics are a phenomenal, look, I'm a quant. I want everything to have a metric, but I only want to apply an appropriate level of significance to each of those metrics. And I certainly don't want to rely on any one or two. And that's what we have going on in the world.
Easy follow-up here. What metric should we use, or metrics? Also, you've talked about a culture shift in hedge funds now. I mean, that's basically what I'm getting from this conversation. And I'm curious, how do you deal with that? And what do you see the future holding for hedge funds?
So I'll say this much. It's hard for me to give a few because I don't put a lot of credence in specific metrics. I would say if you're going to pick between Sharpe ratio or look for something like that, look for Sortino. That looks at upside and downside volatility differently, and I think that's appropriate. I would also say examine what Sortino ratio actually is. There's some papers out there. I think Red Rock actually did a good paper on it. Most hedge funds are not calculating it the right way. Ironically, they're probably biasing themselves on the wrong side of that too. It's not a marketing effort that's doing it the wrong way. It's just the industry is calculating it the wrong way. But that looks at upside and downside volatility different. I think it's a better metric. But I'll tell you that part of the job I have now involves standing up additional trades and traders. And, you know, the things I ask about, I don't really believe in metrics. I believe in understanding where the edge comes from. I'm looking for an economic reason that this strategy works. If you're telling me you're arbing some trend, I'm not a big fan of it. If you tell me that there's certain legislation that requires banks to maintain certain margin requirements. And as a result, they hedge that by buying treasury futures. Okay, well, if you're making money on that, I'm pretty sure that margin requirements are going to continue on big banks. So that's a bet I want to make. So I'm not a big fan of just the metric by itself, but when I evaluate things, I do start off with a metric point. And things I ask are, you know, I'm looking more at the distribution of returns. How many up days do you have versus down days? What's your average up day versus average down day, best up day versus worst down day? You know, I would say get away from looking for a metric that just abstracts you from the whole problem. Don't look for a magic bullet of a number that's going to tell you if this is good or bad. You got to really just start looking at things from a variance perspective. There are probabilities of return on every single investment that you're in. That is the common ground that you can evaluate any strategy against any other strategy. It's variance, which is risk, and return.
That's exactly what I was looking for. Yep. What you just said was exactly what I was looking for.
Now the next question you asked was about the culture shift. I think there's going to be a culture shift just because I think the old culture is not going to be able to live. You know, I don't know if it's, I guess there's a bit of a quixotic slant to how I look at this marketplace, and I'm prone to looking for a lance in the windmill, but, you know, I think that this industry needs to be revamped. I think that, and that's part of what I'm trying to do, but I think you're going to see people go into alternative solutions relative to funding hedge funds that are just the run-of-the-mill, I look like everybody else, I'm never going to differentiate myself. I don't think that has much left in terms of growth. I think that, you know, a lot of these strategies to me look more like execution strategies more than alpha generating strategies. And I think the performance that we see is not indicative of the charges that they're asking for. And that'll go away. I think you'll see robo-advisors and different things come up to compete. But they're not going to compete with real traders. So that's where the culture shift, I think, comes in. I think what we're going to see, and it's driven by a lot of things, I think technology and trading and quant worlds are going to intersect. You know, I think the traders of old are going to have a new value if they're still around because they understand the markets better. And we're going to get past gimmicky technology solutions or gimmicky mass solutions. And we're going to start coming up with ideas that are driven off a better understanding of how the markets behave and why they behave, you know, and then coming up with better approaches to quantify it mathematically and then better approaches to implement a method of interacting with those marketplaces. So, you know, I think the culture shift is we're going to have to provide a value, which it's amazing that we have ever lost sight of that. I don't think I did, but the industry certainly did. And I think the people who are going to be successful are going to be innovators that want to transcend the various areas that make this business successful. So you're going to have to kind of cross the lines of technology, math, and trading. And I think the people that are going to be there are going to be people that want to provide a value. Now, again, I don't want to be idealistic, but there's criticism. Well, actually, look, the 2-in-20 model doesn't make sense if you're just getting average, mundane returns. Right? You should not pay a 2-in-20. But everybody's attacking the 2-in-20 model. It's 2-in-20 is not the problem. If I could guarantee you 200% every year, which I can't, but if I could guarantee that to you, paying me 2-in-20 is a great deal, right? You should do that if it makes sense. If the returns I show are consistent with 2016 in hedge funds, no, a 2-in-20 makes absolutely no sense, right? But, you know, I think we're going after a model, and the model's not the problem. How much you pay isn't the problem. The product and the quality of the product you get is the problem. So I think that paradigm shift is, you know, I think the industry is going to force hedge funds that don't have a value out. And I think if it goes the way I hope it does, I think young creative minds and new technologies are going to intersect with old creative minds that have experience. And I'm kind of bullish on the market. I think if you combine that with some of the things going on in the marketplace, I think there's a lot more opportunity, and I think we'll have a chance to differentiate ourselves. I mean, I'm actually not a huge fan of a 2-in-20, honestly, but that's for other reasons. But I guess I'm more on the side of defending that type of a model because hold me accountable. If I don't produce, fire me. But have an expectation that's commensurate with a 2-20. Don't tell me you're not going to fund me if I can give you a good trade. But if I look like everybody else, then you'll give it to me. That, unfortunately, I fail in that environment because I won't take that capital. Yeah. You want to have, I could buy an at-the-money call, sell an out-of-the-money call, sell an out-of-the-money put, come up with a deterministic rolling procedure, and I'll be 90th percentile in the hedge fund industry. I don't ever want to be that. And that's not a 2-20. That should be a 0.2 and 2%, because I'm not giving you alpha. I'm giving you a strategy that inherently truncates risk in certain exposures and gives you a different return. But you could do that in your E-Trade account if you had a modicum of savvy. Yep. And if you want me to do that for you, I shouldn't charge you for that. Or I should, but for operations. I don't want to be that guy. I want a 2-20, but I actually want to deserve it. And that means that I might not perform as well as your other average fund. I don't want to be average. I want to exceed average. And, you know, the fact that I can put on a dumb strategy and be in the 90th percentile is an absolute travesty. My goal should be in the 80th percentile or the 97th percentile. I shouldn't be trying to shoot to look like everybody else and give you 90, because what we've actually done is we've made it so that 90% of the hedge fund community produces a crappy return.
Jonathan, let's talk about something that you're excited about. I mean, you understand the industry very well. So what's exciting to you from a trading strategy, product, and market perspective?
Interest and volatility. But from 2008, we went into that whole range-based, no-interest environment. And the reality is that, you know, the interesting trading opportunities come when people are making asset class decisions. When people are looking at volatility in the equities market, which gives you a potential of return or loss compared to a reasonable income in the fixed income space, right? You have a decision to move money between treasuries or fixed income and SPX and equity exposure. The ebbs and flows of that investment between the two is where opportunity happens. And the higher the volatility, the more reason to toggle between the two that exists. So interest rates going up is required to even have an alternative worth evaluating. Once volatility starts ebbing and flowing in the equity space, now you have a reason to take advantage of that income in the other space. So if I sit here and take a step back and look at this insane low in interest rates and vol that's occurred over the last 7 to 9 years, I see a change happening. I think the markets are changing. I think, you know, it took a while to shake out the 08 stuff. We have shaken out. I think I see a lot of economic indicators that, from my perspective, are impetus to increase interest rates. And as those interest rates increase, there's more reason to evaluate going over there. And as that happens, you'll see more volatility, in addition to just geopolitics, I think, causing more volatility. This, to me, is opportunity. I think it creates dislocation in price, which is an opportunity, and it creates volume, which is another opportunity. And if you look at the two of those things coming together, I think that there will be a lot of chances for real traders, real investors, to kind of take advantage of that opportunity together. You know, I think that the trading community, the hedge fund community, will facilitate opportunities to exploit those different markets moving kind of in tandem, but obviously not necessarily in a correlated basis. But I think that you're going to see opportunity out of interest rates and vol. That's really driving most of it. I think technology is going to be a facilitator. I don't think it's going to be as much of a differentiator as everybody is expecting it to be. You know, I think a lot of technology becomes commoditized, you know, and I already see that happening, you know, short of some real significant advancements, at least for the next 5 years. I think technology becomes a tool to make things more efficient, and the opportunity is driven out of real developments in the marketplace. You know, there's growth of industry, growth of technology that facilitates exposure, I should say, to more investors. So to the extent that you're growing the size of the pie with technology, you know, that aside, the real opportunity here, it's raw opportunity. I think the markets are changing. I think that we're seeing different behaviors in the markets, and that's going to be where investors and traders can start making money again.
Fantastic perspective today, Jonathan. I can't thank you enough. Now, we're not done. I've got some rapid fire questions for you. So if you're ready for those, I'll begin to fire away.
Absolutely.
All right, everyone. Our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT, the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. First question, how has your trading evolved over the years?
I guess really, when I started off, and I don't want to get too off topic here, but, you know, you have, if you look at physics, physics has quantum physics and then you kind of have general relativity, and there's different behaviors in both. I guess I sort of used to be a quantum mechanics trader. I was dealing with very high frequency, short-term behaviors in the marketplace, you know, and that's because that's where I saw the opportunity. You know, I tend not to have an opinion and try to force it. I tend to formulate an opinion based on observation. So at the time, the easiest way to take advantage of the opportunity in the market, in my opinion, was to take a more mathematical, technological approach on a lower time horizon where information is less relevant. You know, understanding earnings, I'm never going to do as well as an analyst at Goldman Sachs that has more information, more exposure to that information, and can make a more holistic recommendation based on seeing more than I'm seeing. So I don't really want to compete there. But on a very short time scale, information is less valuable. And on an exceedingly short time scale, it has nothing to do with price discovery. Right? You're really more dealing with the frequencies of order placement at that point. So for me, as somebody that didn't know all the information that the competitors in the marketplace had, well, why fight a fight with a knife when you don't have a knife? Don't play that game. And for me, originally, I was looking at higher frequency trading. As technology has advanced and those opportunities were kind of pushed out of the marketplace with competition, I went into slower trading, slower frequency trading. Now, I still have the capacity to intraday trade, and I do. And I also have a trade that trades once a day. So, you know, I'd say the biggest change is I've sort of changed the time horizon of my trading. And if that were to be, analogous to physics, my original example, I've sort of moved from the quantum mechanics of trading into general relativity.
Can you tell me the moment that trading just clicked for you?
Well, I guess I would say I always thought about things in terms of probabilities. So there's probably some core fabric of my thought process that was just very conducive to getting trading. Although it's probably back when I was at Daytech and I sort of built that formula at night that I would take in the next day. You know, I automated my thought process and then took the emotions out of the evaluation by not making any decisions during the day. It was probably right around there. It was when I was able to create a decision tree that generally had me number 1, 2, or 3 in my department for quality of execution. And I watched everybody else working really, really hard at coming in below me. And that's when it kind of clicked. That's when I realized, you know what? This is a logical apparatus problem. If you just have a logical apparatus and think about things, you can come up with a deterministic path of decision. And that's going to exceed my innate ability to trade manually. Now, when it comes to discovery, the human mind far exceeds anything a computer can do right now. But once you figure out what you're looking at, computers can compute far better than my mind can. So I think when I came up with an ability to just run a program and take myself out of the picture, and I could outperform all of the people who were competing with me, that's when I realized, you know what, you probably have a knack for this.
What's the number one source you spend your time on?
The number one most important thing is volume. Right? Volume is where people do transactions. So I look at trades. I am an information whore, data whore. I want as much information as possible. I don't want it cleaned up. I don't want rebroadcast updated prices. I want whatever went out to the street with a timestamp. You know, data sets to me are where I learn things. Trades are most important. Quotes are next most important. But I spend every free second I have where if I'm not building something to roll out in production or developed some code to push out. My hobby outside of things with my kids is just taking data sets. I just like trades specifically because trades are where you had a buyer and a seller come to an agreement. That is price discovery. There's more information and volume at a price, in my opinion, than any other source of data.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
I like Blink. It's a book about how the human mind works. One of the things I found really entertaining throughout trading, and my partner, Dennis Monahan, we sit side by side. And after you run a trade for a while, you kind of get a good feel for the metrics of your trade. And, we used to play this game where I had an optimizer I could run. And I could look at, 100 days of trading, and I could come up with the perfect historical parameters, which generally had a correlation to what the forward parameters should be. Well, it would take me 30 seconds to run this elaborate optimization platform. And, it was a heavy, heavy calc. I could also take 10 seconds and stare at a level 2 depth, Dennis or I, and Dennis would say it should be 3,000 shares. I would say 3,100 shares. And we would do that in about 10 seconds of looking at the market. Another 20 seconds later, the computer would come back and say, it's 3,072 shares. The human mind has this incredible ability to make intuitive leaps between events and behaviors. I think technology, the math guys of the world, the computer science guys of the world that are only looking at where they come from, are not considering the value of the human mind. Technology has made massive advancements, but we're not at a point of singularity yet. And even when we are, we don't have the luxury of experience and evolution to get us to where we are. I don't think we've come anywhere near exploiting the capabilities of just the eye and the mind. And Blink is a book that talks about how the mind works. And if you think about where I think the market's going, I think it's the great minds coming in contact now with the great academic minds and the great computer science minds. And that's the future. But I think there's too much of a focus on what computers can do, when we haven't really optimized what the mind is already able to do. So Blink, probably my favorite book about the market, and it's not directly about the market, but the market price is it's a manifestation of human opinion. Right? Supply and demand, it's what people think. You can't forget about the human in the picture, and I think Blink is a great book that makes you evaluate how your own mind works, and it helps you understand where you should rely on your thoughts and where you should rely on technology.
What's your favorite movie or TV show about trading or the markets?
This is kind of embarrassing, especially because I think I have somewhat of a technology disposition, although I'm not a technologist. I don't really watch TV or movies. If I do, it's science fiction, it's Star Wars or superheroes.
What's the best piece of advice you've received about trading or the markets?
So the best piece of advice I ever received was to know thyself first. You need to know why you make money and why you don't. And I think understanding how little you understand is the most important thing. The people I respect most in the market, the Thomas Petterfees, the Blair Hulls, look, they have opinions. They have opinions because they've been in the market for 35, 40 years. But if you listen to them speak, they don't speak with an absolute certainty of knowledge. And that's because this market will teach you that you don't know in brutal fashion if you don't accept that fact early on. And, a lot of the guys that have taught me about the market, they've all taught me to know my limitations, to figure out where I think I make money and where I don't know. And I've not figured out how to make money on what I do know. I figured out how to make money by avoiding what I don't know. And that's probably the most crucial piece of advice I ever had. If you find something that you think is valuable, if you find a strategy that works for you, just because you haven't seen it blow up doesn't mean it's not there. And if you understand why you make money, you have a chance of finding that place where you blow up. And that's where you have to buy your insurance policy. That's where you buy your hedge, you put your stop loss in, you come up with some mitigating approach to dealing with that portion of what's an expected distribution in your strategy. And that has to do with knowing yourself, knowing what you know, what you don't know, and why your trade works and why it doesn't work. Having that simple concept pointed out to me. I've never designed a trade without thinking about why I make money, why I think I'm good at what I do in this particular trade, and where I have risk, because I know my limitations.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading, what would it be?
As it relates to newer trends in technology and math, study your ass off. Just because you're not a applied math major, mathematics is in life. It's everywhere. It's part of the physics that make everything work. It's part of the calculation you have in your own head to figure out what you're going to do with your family. You just don't realize it is. Don't be afraid of math. Everybody thinks that you're not going to use that math in high school. Well, you're not if you choose not to. So one, embrace mathematics. Two, trading is now coding. Become familiar with technology. You don't have to be a computer engineer, but you should learn the code. You should learn how infrastructure works. And three, find old traders in the industry, people that saw interest rates. You know, intelligence is not a proxy for experience. And, you know, it's hard for young people to accept the fact that no matter how smart they are, maybe the dumb guy that has experience might be able to help you. Open your eyes. You know, when you talk to someone that has experience, you don't have to come to the same conclusions, but recognize the ratio of ears to mouth. You got two ears and one mouth. Listen more than speak. People underestimate other people's experience. And just because there's been a paradigm shift in the market doesn't mean that there's not still lessons to glean. And truthfully, the real trading opportunities, they're going to come when technology catches up with the old way of trading. And everybody kind of thinks it's the other way, but it's not.
Final question for today. If you weren't a trader, you'd be what?
Well, my brother is a quantum physicist up in Sudbury, Canada, 2 kilometers underground studying dark matter in a nickel mine. I'd probably be working next to him, especially when you consider the fact that if you dug up the mathematics that are behind most of my trades, I deal with time decay using a thermodynamics model. My brother uses the same particle filter for his own work that I use for stock prices. So my trading, the math I use to quantify the behaviors in the market that I want to exploit, it's an exercise in physics. And I guess if I wasn't a trader, I would either be a stay-at-home dad, because the truth is I prefer to be playing with my kids than talking to you right now. And if not, I'd be a physicist.
I mean, Jonathan, great stuff today. Appreciate your perspective, your insight. It was awesome. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add to today's show?
Actually, just one brief thing. Your sponsor, TT, I use them. You know, they have a great offering for the type of trading that I'm doing currently. They have facilitated at least what I've made money on in the last 2 years. So thank you very much to your sponsor.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Yeah, TT is the best. No doubt about that. I appreciate you coming on Futures Radio Show today, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Awesome. Thank you very much, man. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.